You got yourself a drink? You got anything for the occasion?
Just water. I drank all that. I drank that whole bottle of champagne in the Hidden Life episode.
That's right. That's right. I got myself a little cocktail here.
Oh, yeah?
A little nice winter cocktail. Chai, coffee, whiskey, maple syrup.
Oh, that sounds good. The only Christmas time cocktail I really know is, you know, eggnog and brandy.
I'll go for that, too. Well, let's talk about movies one last time.
You should do the intro. Yeah, you should do the intro.
Hello and welcome to A Century in Cinema. My name is Arthur. I'm a local filmmaker here in Utah, and I'm just happy to be here.
And my name is Andrew. I am a professional film historian, and I'm happy to be here, too, all the way at the end.
Here at the end of all things.
Are you predicting the apocalypse?
No, it's just the Lord of the Rings thing.
Fair enough. I've never seen it.
You didn't send any show notes today, so we're gonna jump around a little bit.
Oh, was I supposed to?
No. Usually that is my guide. I'm like, okay, I know that there's a roadmap ahead. I'm trusting the plan, but today I'm just like, well, who knows what's gonna happen?
Yeah.
We have a little bit of a plan.
So, I mean, normally we would say this is a podcast where we talk about a movie, blah, 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 but we're not really doing that today. We're just doing sort of a little retrospective on the project and doing a little wrap-up episode. We are recording this on December 18th. So it's just about a month since our last episode released. We had other projects and other things that we needed to complete, and we needed to get to a good space to be able to record this episode and didn't want to rush it in any way. So here we are at the end. But if you're listening to this, you know, all in one fell swoop, it just is the ending. So there you go.
I think a lot of people might listen to this as their very first episode, too.
This is a weird one to start off with. This is a weird one to start off with. You're welcome to be here, but this is a weird one to start off with.
It's going to be at the top of the list now, you know? We already did a sort of free jazz episode right in the middle of our Century in Cinema list. That was our intermission episode.
Mm-hmm.
And in that episode, we go ahead and introduce ourselves for the very first time. It's a weird place to introduce ourselves. But since this is maybe the first episode that a lot of people will listen to, I figure, Andrew, let's go ahead and introduce ourselves one last time. Like, who are we? Who are you?
Who am I? At this point in my life, I am a 31-year-old, out and proud gay man living in Salt Lake City, Utah. I am an actor and a film lover and a high-strung social coordinator, as well as a video gamer. And I enjoy baking desserts and cooking large meals and spending time with my close friends. And yeah, I think that's a good intro spot.
It's all true. It's all true. Especially, I mean, those meals are really good.
Oh, and I worked at Salt Lake Film Society for a little while, which is one of the reasons Arthur pulled me onto this project 2 years ago.
It's true. In our intermission episode, you had described yourself as a film historian, more so than a film critic, because film criticism is quote unquote dead. No changes there.
No changes there. If anything, it's gotten worse.
All right. I can respect that. I think I'd agree.
But I do appreciate film and film history, and I will watch anything once. I watched The Spy Who Dumped Me last night. I didn't much care for it. It wasn't my kind of thing.
Yeah, I wouldn't have guessed that would be your cup of tea, but good on you.
The things we do for love, Arthur. The things we do for love.
And my name is Arthur Venema. I'm a filmmaker here in Utah. I have worked in the local film industry here in and around Salt Lake City since 2015 when I graduated from the University of Utah. I've been on some productions like HBO's Mosaic and Paramount Network's Yellowstone for a couple of seasons. I've also produced a number of short films, and that's the professional. That's like the professional bio.
Right.
I absolutely love films because I absolutely love monster movies and like dinosaur movies like Jurassic Park and Godzilla are some of my all-time favorites. And that's, I think, what got me into cinema. That's the kind of film I like to make. That's the kind of film I want to keep making, is big old monster movies. I remember in the intermission episode, I said that I had become a little more jaded about working on film sets. I think that's gotten even more true as time has gone on, and I've settled more into writing and screenwriting and also just short stories and things like that. I joined a little writer's group. That's been a lot of fun. I've been exploring that a little bit more. Also, since the Austin Film Festival, which I had not gone to at the time of our recording the intermission episode, I have really found a new love and respect for more and more writing.
Hmm.
Yeah, Austin Film Festival is known as a writer's film festival. There's a lot of writers there, a lot of great writing sessions and seminars and stuff like that. So that was a great experience, the Austin Film Festival, and that kind of marked a shift in my thinking about kind of what I want to do. But I'm still figuring out exactly what I want to do. I know I love films. I know I like working in and around films, but there's a lot you can do in the world of cinema. I think I'm still kind of figuring it out and seeing what I like.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Going back to you, Andrew, also since the intermission episode, you had been saying that you were, doing a little bit more theater with Elise. And since then, I think I've seen a lot of shows that have been directed by Elise and starring you, including the one you mentioned, Secret Son of Hitler. Good job to both of you on that one.
Thank you. Yes, and I just finished up a production of Angels in America, which was one of the most artistically satisfying projects I've ever had the pleasure of working on. It was an incredible experience over the past 6 months of my life, and I really put everything I had into it, and I feel like the results showed that, and I was very proud of it.
As you should be, yeah. The two-part epic play, saw both parts, and extremely well done. Good job to all of you.
Thank you.
And since the intermission episode, I had mentioned that my short film, The Atomic Spawn, was going to the Austin Film Festival, and it also went and premiered online in the summer of 2022. It was distributed by the YouTube channel Omeletto, which was very exciting because they have a very large subscriber base. So by far, it is the short film seen by the most people that I've ever made. And it's very, it's so cool to see just random people commenting and, 20,000 views come in on this short film. I couldn't have asked for a more, successful end to that project. I'm really happy with how The Atomic Spawn came out. And that's my own little monster movie, little stop motion monster movie. Worked with a great group of other filmmakers. Again, if you're coming to this as your first episode, maybe go check that out. I'm really proud of it.
I only ever watched The Atomic Spawn through the exclusive screener link that was sent to me. I actually, this is my first time looking it up on YouTube. I didn't realize that they'd given it a buzz title.
Oh yeah, you gotta give it a buzz title.
A scientist discovers a mysterious egg at a nuclear test site, then it hatches.
Which is not the title of the film, but it is how you get views on YouTube.
They put The Atomic Spawn after that, in all fairness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Wow, yeah, look at all these nice comments.
There's maybe one or two that weren't so nice, and I do remember
Don't
those
read
quite
those.
Clearly, but
why are you even reading anything past the most liked comments? Yeah, I really enjoyed that short film. That was a good job.
Thank you.
And I've seen The Atomic Spawn in real life. I've seen the puppet.
The puppets, they still live. They mm-hmm. live.
They live on. They live past us all.
They will survive us all. I just worked on a little film set, just something for my full-time job. I work at the University of Utah now, making science education videos, and we just shot something 2 days ago, and it was the first time that I was back on like sort of a bigger set. It was still a really small set, but it did remind me how much I really love directing. And yeah, I just haven't worked on a set in a long time.
Yeah.
In any capacity, properly, really. But I miss it a little bit. I miss some of it for sure. But like I said, I've become really jaded about film sets. I mean, when we did our intermission episode, it was right before the IATSE strike was about to happen. And I just remember all these stories coming out that made me think, yeah, that's terrible. Like, who wants this life? Who wants this life making movies, working in this industry? And then, of course, the Rust shooting happened where the director of photography was shot on set. And I just remember thinking, yeah, of course, because, yeah, film sets are dangerous. This didn't surprise me at all. So I'm just trying to rethink, like, what is my relationship with making movies and what kind of movies do I want to make in what capacity? So.
And I worked on a few film sets a long time ago and gave up that dream because it wasn't even ever part of my dream. It was just sort of this path that opened up for me, and I will walk down any path that opens up for me. And I suddenly felt that that was not the right path, and mm-hmm. I didn't want to continue down it. So I turned. So I absolutely understand that emotion, because you went much farther than I did. I mean, you're still working in the industry for sure, and like, you haven't made any definitive decision. I'm just saying, working on film sets is really stressful. It takes up a lot of your time and energy, and then you're never even sure what the product is going to be. The artistic satisfaction is a huge bet all the way to the end.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's selfish, but it's like, I like doing it when I'm directing. I like doing it when I have that artistic satisfaction and, you know, I know that I have creative control. Mm-hmm. But yeah, when you don't have creative control, when you're just there making someone else's dreams come true, so to speak, or, I don't know, just putting together a project, no one really cares about it. Like, what are we doing? What are we doing? Yeah. I don't know. I still miss a lot of the camaraderie that arises on set. It's trauma bonding for sure, but a lot of my greatest friends I met on film sets, so I yeah. do miss that kinship that I used to have with a lot of people. But I'm really happy that I have a new like best friend in Andrew Slaughter over here.
Aww.
through this project Same. Century and Cinema.
Yes, we've become very close over the past couple of years, as I think that we both maybe subconsciously knew that. But that wasn't why we started the project. But yes, it has been very nice to go from being casual acquaintances. And we always, you know, really liked each other's presences. And then yeah. to essentially co-workers. And we were both working so hard and doing so much. Like, we both had full-time jobs and were doing artistic projects outside of this. And so it was like this secret third job that we both had. That was like, we talk about trauma bonding. There were some recording nights where we were both like, okay, I am so fucking done right now. Like, I want to make this episode because this project is really meaning a lot to me, but also I'm just so exhausted. There were a few episodes. I mean, Arthur really always saved it in the edit, but there are a few episodes that are sort of difficult for me to listen to, because I know so much of me, like, being so exhausted and so, like, done with certain things was edited out. And I'll let the listeners decide if they can pick out which episodes it is. I mean, it isn't a whole lot of them.
Oh, no.
It isn't a whole lot of them.
It's not a lot of them.
But there were a handful that I'm like, oh, man, that was a rough, rough day.
And Give them one. What's one episode?
Oh, one episode was Noah.
Oh yeah.
Noah, I was on the brink during that entire recording, and it sucked because I really enjoyed my revisit of the movie and I was thoroughly enjoying the project itself, but then getting together and recording and having to do something that Sunday just felt like the end of everything for some reason. And you know, that's always part of any sort of project. Podcasting is hard. It's not as simple as it might seem. I mean, for both of us, you were doing a lot of the work on the back end with the presentation, and I was doing a lot of the work on the back end with, you know, the planning of it and getting things together and notes and whatnot. And together, mm-hmm. we both put in like quite a few hours every single week for this project for 2 years.
There's some Patreon episode where we break down the hours or something like that. But yeah, it comes out to about like 10 hours per week.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little job in and of itself.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, overall, it was a very satisfying project to work on, and I'm very proud of it as a whole. I have listened to every single episode at least twice.
I know what you mean, though, about the... I know what you mean, though, coming into, like, work on this, sometimes when you're just like, I do not want to work on this.
Yeah.
And my episode has got to be Pink Flamingos.
Oh, man, I remember that. I remember
yeah.
that.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a tough shoot. But I was really like just bringing it. I was like, okay, I've got to not only defend this movie that I love, but I gotta, you know, make this episode super entertaining and like get it all together because I've got a major straight man as my
very straight.
I don't know why that word wouldn't come to me for a second. Good Lord.
Well, we do have something like a plan for this wrap-up episode, and it is a retrospective. We both went back and listened to a handful of episodes. And why did we do that, Andrew?
Well, I wanted to listen to some episodes and circle back on some things that were mentioned in them. And I also just wanted to discuss how I feel about the episode as a whole. And I wanted to sort of take one from each of the distinctive eras of the podcast for me. So that I settled on 4 episodes. I don't know how many you listened to.
I listened to 3, technically 4, because I re-listened to our intermission episode.
That was a good call. I didn't listen to that one.
Are we challenging each other on our views, seeing if anything has changed? Is there any?
There are some things that I found interesting that not only do I want to address myself, but yeah, I do have some questions for you.
I got to defend myself. But that's OK. I'm ready.
Yeah, I'm ready to defend myself, too. I mean, who's going first? We also don't know what episodes the other person picked. And out of 100, when you're only picking 3 or 4, you would hope that there isn't much overlap. But we literally don't know. It's a big chance.
There's a big chance there might be some overlap because there are certain episodes that are a little controversial in the meta of A Century in Cinema. I'm curious if we pick those episodes.
Huh. Okay. So the first one I re-listened to was The Thief of Baghdad, starring Douglas Fairbanks.
That's the movie you forgot we watched.
So many times. So many times.
What is it for the audience? It's 1924.
And okay. It was a huge blockbuster from Hollywood's golden era.
Of the silent age.
Right. And this episode was really funny because we were both talking about how floored we were by the effects and how much it was an impressive spectacle, but how the story and the performances did nothing for us. And then we both forgot we'd seen it, like, as the project went on, which was fascinating.
That just goes to show you that, you know, great effects do not carry a film. You know, you got to have good characters and story, mm-hmm. you know, et cetera, et cetera. These are things that everyone says, so it's true.
So I first wanted to, do you remember that we read this review that referred to it as a clever satire?
Yeah, I really liked that review, too. It was like an old-timey review. It felt so aged.
Right. In retrospect, it is just impossible for me to see that film as a satire, especially at this point. Maybe I should revisit it with that lens.
I don't think anyone needs to revisit it.
extremely racist boring. Film, and it was very and it was long. Neither of us called it boring in the episode. In fact, we both said we were highly entertained. We both took a makeshift intermission during the film. And the one thing I'm sad about and that I could not remember now, and I know you probably couldn't either, is when I took mine and when you took yours. We didn't actually say that on the episode, and I kind of wish we had documented that, because I think that would have been interesting. But what really struck out to me, and you'll probably have similar views on this for your early episode, was on this one, there was very little discussion of history of the time period. There was no discussion of film history at all. I mean, the whole thing was sort of being linked to film history in this way, and I was making these references to other points.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, I didn't give any recommendations, which I did remember happened later, but it felt so weird to hear an episode without the recommendations that I think anyone who does listen to these backwards, once they hit that pocket of early episodes without them, it's like, wait, where's that aspect? And I don't even know if I would have had five recommendations from 1924.
Right. Yeah. There's just so few films back then.
But yeah, it's that was very interesting for me. I'm still obsessed with Anna May Wong. I still love her as an actor. I still seek her movies out. I was really grateful to have been given that platform to talk about my love for her and her little history with Hollywood and all of her tiffs. It was really fascinating listening to all of that again because it immediately came back to me when I started talking about her sort of tragic trajectory in Hollywood stardom.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I was most interested in was, I don't think I care about the way those early episodes sound. I feel like
they sound awful.
You think so?
I sound awful. I know that.
I don't know. I was surprised by how little it bothered me. And I was listening to it on a big speaker. And I thought, oh, I mean, we did sound better later. But I remember there were people who were saying that it was like unlistenable. And maybe my ears just aren't attuned to that.
They just meant the actual content of the show. Something they can't listen to.
Oh.
That's
But I don't even know what episode it is when we started talking about how we were going to fix the sound. I remember recording that. I have a memory of recording that part of an episode once where we said, we've heard your complaints and we're changing things about our setups and we're going to make the sound better. And we did do that. And I'm very happy about that.
We did do that, yeah.
But yeah, I don't even remember when that happened.
It was a slow process, slow improvement, at least on my end. I recorded this show in three different houses. I mean, three different locations in my life. And each time I would kind of subtly improve things here and there. At one point, I got a better microphone. At another point, I put the microphone on an arm, so there's a little bit less reverb. And then in my last location here, which I have total control over, I have nice sound panels on the wall and everything. But I do have a heater running right now, so I do apologize for that.
Yeah, I, on the other hand, did everything in one fell swoop. I already had a bunch of paneling up, and then the only change I made was that the microphone was originally on this little stand that was on the desk, and it caused a weird echo, and I didn't have a pop filter. So I bought a pop filter and a stand, but besides that, I didn't make really any other changes, but that ended up doing the trick.
Yeah, and I think you sound really good. You always consistently sounded pretty good.
I think so. I think we both have.
But
yeah, I don't really have any lingering questions from that one. I did want to ask, do you feel after this project, to a certain extent, that you were a little less intimidated by longer films? Because that's one of your big points in Thief of Baghdad, is that you were really intimidated by length and in general are intimidated by long films. And then you ask me how I'm able to watch long films and I give like my tips and tricks for it.
I still don't like just like seeing in my calendar like a huge chunk of my day being swallowed up by a film. It's still a little intimidating for me. If something's 90 minutes, I'm so thankful. I'm like, yes, please, let's in and out. And then I can get on with my day. And in general, those are just a much more positive experience versus like, a, I don't know, 3-4 hour long film. Sometimes it's just it becomes like what the whole day is about. And I just feel like, not that I've wasted time, but that it's just like swallowed up something.
Hmm.
In the case of some films, that's great if it's a good film, but I don't know. Sometimes it's not so great. Thief of Baghdad. I don't know. I don't know if that needed to be 3 hours. I think I was tricking myself into saying, yeah, that was really good.
I also liked us talking about how some of the effect work was really great, but some of it came across as really cheesy. And at first we sort of tried to defend it, but then we read the review where the guy said some of these effects are really cheesy, like even in 1924. And that was really funny for us to read.
I mean, yeah, I was going to say for the time period, they probably looked good compared to, you know, the other films we were watching, like Phantom Carriage. But
Well, I mean, yeah, overall, I was very impressed with the episode. It makes me want to go back and re-listen to the whole project, because after listening to that, I thought, wait, I don't remember a lot of what I said on this. And what else did I say in all these other episodes?
What other hidden gems are there?
Yes.
Or what other embarrassing moments?
Exactly.
Well, I re-listened to another film from the silent era, Nanook of the North, which is famous for being the father of the documentary genre, the very first documentary. And that's not true. We say many times on the podcast, whenever we say that something is the first time something happened, like it's just not true. Like someone else did it first, but this is the one that got famous. So Nanook of the North is the first big famous documentary film from the silent era. It's about Inuits. They're called Eskimos in the film. Also, famously, a lot of it is staged. A lot of it is kind of like made to look more primitive than the Inuit people actually were at the time. So I found it a little problematic for that reason. And I had some thoughts. I had some thoughts on it, and I wanted to see if my thoughts had changed. So I revisited Nanook of the North. And yeah, I was also struck by how unstructured the beginning of the episode was. Just like Thief of Baghdad, like we just get right to the
yeah.
film. Like, there's nothing to talk about. Let's just get to it. we slowly develop a structure. And then eventually that becomes like a large part of the podcast, is us just talking about the world history and film history and our favorite films from that year and things we'd recommend and whatnot. So it was a little quaint.
So when did you revisit Nanook of the North? When did you rewatch that?
Sorry, didn't revisit and watch Nanook of the North.
Okay, now I understand. I understand.
Listen to the episode, yeah. I don't think I'd revisit Nanook of the North. I've seen it once now, so I'm like, I've seen it.
I remember being really blown away by that movie. I remember when I watched it, I remember I really loved it.
And it's fine. It's good. But yeah, I had a slimy feeling, like just knowing that like the filmmaker, Robert Flaherty? Yeah, Robert Flaherty was like lying to the audience. Like, I couldn't get over that. He was lying to us about things and calling it a documentary. Like, that just made me angry. And I think I'm still a little angry about it.
And I think my point in that episode was that every documentary is lying to you.
Yes, that is your point. But then I still maintain this. I'm saying there's a spectrum of truth. There's a spectrum of truth telling, right? Like, they are staging things and making the Inuit people like hunt with spears when they would normally hunt with rifles, and he makes them look like idiots by having them like try to chew on a record and they don't know what it is. They think they can eat it and stuff like that. Like, it's so silly. Like, I don't know where the line is. I don't know where I suddenly become angry with a documentary for lying to me. I know every documentary has an angle and that the filmmaker is trying to get something across to us. But in the case of Nanook of the North, I think what they're trying to get across is like these people are they're primitive and look at them and like just marvel at how primitive they are. But they still make it work. They can still live in this bitter cold environment, and wow, isn't that crazy. And I don't know, it's not utterly disrespectful. Like, it still is saying, wow, they live in this environment and they make it work, but I don't know, it still makes them look like fools sometimes.
Do you have any questions concerning Nanook of the North?
Does it make you angry when a film is like deliberately lying to its audience?
I'm very slow to anger in general. And
I guess that's true.
I don't know. I don't know if angry is the right word. I've definitely been frustrated to a certain extent with some films when I discover that there was a huge truth about it being kept away. But then I feel like I always have this sort of safety switch that goes off in my brain that's like, well, that's what every movie does, Andrew. Every single movie omits information. Every single movie has a perspective. So, you know, you can't go to movies seeking exact truth from them. You can find truth through film, but it isn't necessarily going to be from the information they give you. Is that weird? Does that make any sense?
I can see what you're saying in that, yeah, there's always an angle. There's always a perspective.
I remember making a comment on that I was embarrassed by, where I was talking about, like, how nice and quaint their lives seemed. I regret that in retrospect.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, we all make mistakes. That was just the way I was feeling in the moment.
The film makes it look kind of nice. Yeah, the film makes it look kind of nice. I don't know. They're happy. They are smiling on camera.
But I also remember being really proud of finding that older documentary that is considered by most historians to be the first documentary about the shipwreck, and it was mostly still images, and watching that on YouTube and everything. I remember putting a lot of effort into the research of that episode in general.
That was one of our very first episodes, yeah, where we were trying to go above and beyond for every single episode.
How fast did we record those first five? I remember we recorded five before we released anything. Well, no, we recorded 10, and then we released the first five so that we'd have backlog to release weekly.
That's right. It was like we released them all in 1 week or something like that.
Yeah, well, we released the first five in 1 week, and then we still had like four or five more to release.
Mm-hmm. And I think we were still just recording one episode a week. So I guess we recorded it for like 10 weeks or so, and then we released it.
Yeah. That's to say nothing of the Metropolis episode.
A marvelous episode. You got to be proud of that one,
right? I am proud of it. I should have revisited that one, but I still just remember the shock, horror, and terror between both of us after recording for 2 hours and realizing that none of my audio had been recorded. I still remember that moment.
We recorded it twice. We recorded Metropolis twice.
Yeah.
That's why it's so good. We did a take two.
Yeah, exactly. I was able to edit down my thoughts a little bit. And I had made a list of all of the things I remembered discussing. But yes, I mean, I poured my whole life into Metropolis for a little while, for about a year or two. So it was nice to distill all of that information I'd gathered into a podcast episode. Yeah, I should have revisited that one, but who cares? Shoulda, woulda, coulda.
To answer the question I asked you, does it make me angry if a filmmaker is like deliberately lying to me? I mean, yeah. Yeah. I'm okay with a filmmaker having a perspective, having an angle, having something to say that maybe doesn't align with the truth. I mean, that sucks sometimes when it's clearly not correct. But if the filmmaker is being honest and they think that this is like how the world works and this is how they see the world, like, I got to respect the idea that they are telling their truth through their art. I think that is a respectable position for an artist to have. If you stand up in front of your audience and try to pull the wool over their eyes, if you're deliberately lying to them and you know it's a lie, this is not how you see the world, and you're just doing it for, I don't know, a financial gain, you know, just to trick people, like, I don't like that so much. That's not cool.
Yeah.
Especially in a documentary. I'd say that's where I would draw my line. Yeah.
Yeah.
What's your second film that you watched?
My second film is one of the ones I'm most proud of. I love this episode so much. And that is Orpheus 1950.
Oh, lovely. Lovely.
I poured my heart and soul into this episode. It was a re-record after we had recorded an entire episode on a film called No Way Out, starring Sidney Poitier, that we just were not pleased with the way the episode had come out. We were both sort of meh on the movie. We felt like the messages it was trying to get across were important for their time, but they were presented in a way that was extremely of their time, in a way that it's tough to translate that film into a modern perspective. And we were sort of just left at this sort of crossroads of Of course, we want to have an episode about a film that discusses racial discrimination from this time period, but this one is so weird and exploitative, and there were so many mines in the minefield. And at the end of it, I remember feeling like sort of iffy at the end of recording, but I remembered that Arthur always saved it. And then Arthur texted me or called me a few days later and said, I'm putting this together and I hate it. I hate this episode. We need to do something different. And do you have any ideas? And I said, well, my favorite film from 1950. And I'd gone on about this film in that episode at the beginning. And that was Orpheus by Jean Cocteau. And so he said, perfect, let's just do that one. And I got to listen to the commentary track from James Williams on the film. And I learned even more about the movie than I'd already learned. And I'd already learned a whole bunch. And this episode is really fun for me to listen to, because I remember when we started recording, I wasn't sure what all Arthur knew about the making of the movie. And it turned out he just didn't know anything at all. So
I didn't know anything.
Every single time I peeled back another layer of the controversies around Jean Cocteau, Arthur just gets more and more flabbergasted with all of the details around this man's life.
The juicy details.
Yes. And I still love when I reveal that, you know, his lover was his adopted son at the time. You're just going, oh my God. You just have such a nice reaction to that, such a shocked reaction to it. And I love that. Yeah, I'm really proud of that episode.
What is Orpheus about for the listeners who haven't watched that film or listened to that episode?
Well, it's the tale of Orpheus as told through the eyes of Jean Cocteau. You might be aware of Jean Cocteau through his adaptation of Beauty and the Beast from the early 1940s. This was his next sort of big spectacle film, and it is the second part of an artistic trilogy about the tortures of being an artist and the tortures of being a poet. And yeah, it was just a really perfect year for us to have a movie that we weren't happy with discussing, because I could discuss Orpheus for forever. It is a movie that has many, many layers and has a good sense of humor, incredible visual effects, which we talk about a lot in the movie.
Really simple, subtle, but incredible visual effects.
Yeah. You talk about we talk about the journey into hell, the effect of Bertuis being at the front and sort of floating and standing still, while there is the backdrop camera work and the lighting on him. It happens before the lighting and the backdrop, and it's supposed to represent, you know, all of these different images going by. And you say that you think that the effect does not work for you at all. Do you have any memories of that?
Yeah, now that you bring that effect up, I remember not loving that one. But there are some incredible practical, like things where they seem to be turning the set and gravity seems to be shifting. The world seems to be flipping upside down. That worked really, really well for me.
Yes, them filming inside of the empty pool. And yeah, I love your reaction to that in the podcast, too, because you were like, yeah, I thought they were just being actors with wind blowing against them. And they were just sort of up against a wall acting like they were pressed against it. And then when they fell, then they got like sucked down into Hades. You were like, what? How did they do that?
Yeah. Yeah. There's great stuff in there.
Mm-hmm. There's also a certain calming presence about that episode. I feel like we both feel way more confident and are very delighted that we are discussing this film. And it feels like, you know, we've sort of found a way to create a safety net in a situation that we hadn't had to deal with before.
Mm.
And I like that aspect of it, too. It has sort of a personal meaning to me, which is one of the reasons I picked it.
I dig it. Well, as long as we're in the 1950s, should we talk about the film that I chose?
I would love to hear what your film was.
Well, it had to be The Searchers.
Okay, I thought about that one. I did. And then I decided that was too risky.
It was too risky, yeah.
I thought this was going to be one that we might both listen to, so I decided not to. I decided to go for Orpheus.
Yeah, I mean, The Searchers was such a strange experience for me because it's regarded as one of the greatest films of all time. There are so many great filmmakers from our generation, Steven Spielberg, you know, George Lucas, and even back in the day, my favorite filmmaker, Akira Kurosawa, they all love The Searchers. They all love John Ford. And John Wayne is such an American icon that I was looking forward to this. And I've said it before, I really love Westerns. So we get into this and yeah, it's a Western, but it's all the things I really don't like about Westerns. It's racial politics and its depiction of Native Americans is just abysmal. And it kind of flipped a switch where I just said, wow, I mean, I like Westerns, but I hate Westerns too. So it really made me wrestle with the stories that American filmmakers tell and the myths that are perpetuated through films. And this, again, it's sort of like lying to your audience. It's this deliberate misdirection of how history went and how the genocide of the Native Americans went down. It's depicted in such a way that, you know, Americans nowadays probably think of John Wayne and John Ford's depiction of the events, and, you know, what actually happened in history has been totally buried. So that just that rubs me the wrong way.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the film is silly too. So I don't know. How do you feel? You are way more forgiving of The Searchers in the moment, but I can even feel as we're talking about the film in the episode that your feelings shift. And you're into the aesthetics. You love the look of it. It is a beautiful film. You know, Monument Valley has never looked better. But the aesthetics don't save this, do they?
They don't. And it's funny because I thought that might be the question you asked. Because in the moment of recording that episode, I felt this need to maybe not defend it as much, just sort of be a neutral voice because you really, really hated it. And I was not a fan when I watched it, and I had a feeling when I watched it that it might be very negative from both of us, but I didn't just want to start off an episode saying every director says this is the best movie, but we hate it. Like, I didn't want that to be the vibe. I wanted to come at it from a more even standpoint. So I really tried to be, you know, to talk about where the film is coming from, why it was considered progressive for its time, regardless of how progressive we see it as in 2020 or 2021. And I remember feeling that way even upon watching the movie. I was like halfway through the movie and realized that was going to need to be my stance. So I was prepared going into that episode, and then exactly what I thought would happen happened. So I stood my ground and stood by what I thought the merits of the movie were. But yes, especially in retrospect, I was not a big fan of that film. I don't think I will ever watch it again. And it was it was almost disturbing, the amount of casual racism in the film, as well as the well-intentioned but completely mishandled sort of white savior narrative in the finale. I mean, it's just a very confusing message and a confusing moral in the gorgeous Western.
Yeah. And, you know, I think filmmakers nowadays are all in agreement that The Birth of a Nation is a despicable film. Mm-hmm. But I still see plenty of filmmakers and people who love cinema still have a ton of respect for John Ford and John Wayne and The Searchers. Even though, to me, I see the same tropes and the same sort of racism in The Searchers that I saw in The Birth of a Nation. So I think it's time is coming. I don't think it will have defenders in the future. But it is the fact that it is so well regarded, the fact that so many filmmakers hold it on such a pedestal, that I think it was so disturbing to me. Versus, you know, the more recent Western we watched, Bone Tomahawk, which is still abysmal in its racial politics, but, you know, no one's out there championing it as the best film of all time. And
who is? Oh, no one.
No.
I thought for a second you said Nolan is like Christopher Nolan. I was like, what?
No, he's
I need
not.
I need you to pull that quote. No, I need to see that for my own eyes.
Right. No. So you've seen this myth, this horrific depiction of Native Americans and the Indian Wars go from, you know, Hollywood's bread and butter and something as big as The Searchers. And now it's like a micro budget Western that's more of a cult film. But it's still sort of the terrible racist depiction of Native Americans while still like thinking that it's being progressive. I don't know. It is pretty, though. There is something later in that episode that we start to talk about. And that's that, you know, just because we didn't like this one film from John Ford, and I haven't seen a lot of John Ford films. I don't know if I've seen many, if any at all, besides The Searchers.
You should watch Stagecoach. You would like that, I think.
Oh, I've seen Stagecoach. Yeah. That's right. I thought I'd seen something else. But I mean, John Ford is such a prolific, well-regarded, like highly respected filmmaker. It's crazy to judge a filmmaker's entire career on one film. It's crazy to watch a film like The Searchers and quickly go over it in like a week of research and then go on to the next thing. So there is something about that film in particular that made me realize that we can't go deep in this project. We can go on like a little side quest and go on a Joseph von Sternberg binge like I did. Mm-hmm. But we can't do that every week for every director. And John Ford is right. Definitely a director where maybe he deserves something like that. But I just didn't have time to do it.
Yeah, and I remember doing that for George Clouseau when we did Les Corbeaux. I remember being like, oh, I'm going to watch... Why have I only seen two films from this guy? And now I just watched the third one, and it was yet again one of the best thrillers I've ever watched. So I just went through and watched every movie of his I could find within that week. And yeah, I looked at that episode too. I thought about listening to that one too. That was really nice to be able to do. And in retrospect, I agree with you. It's like, wait, how on earth did I fit that into my time frame? I couldn't do that for any, like, so many films I couldn't do that kind of work for. But for some reason, I was able to watch, like, all of this director's work in the course of a week for this episode.
Right, right.
It's so weird.
But John Ford seems like a director who definitely deserves a little bit more attention than the little blurb we gave him in our episode on The Searchers.
Right.
If I were a proper filmmaker, proper film historian, I would do a little bit more. And, you know, the same goes for like almost all of these films and all these filmmakers. They do deserve more attention. And if you like one of them, it's definitely worth it to check out the rest of their filmography. Or the rest of the franchise. In the case of Twilight, which, you know, I still haven't done. I still haven't binged the rest of the Twilight saga like I promised I would in that episode.
We should watch New Moon together. We should do that
soon. We should just watch New Moon together. Yes. Yes.
I would love to watch New Moon with you. New Moon's the best one, I think.
Yeah.
Besides Breaking Dawn Part 2, of course. But New Moon is hilarious.
Scene. For that one scene.
Yeah. No, for the whole thing. For the whole thing.
Okay.
Breaking Dawn Part 2 is like a masterpiece. Yeah, the Saw series too. The Saw series, you were like, I gotta watch these.
Yeah, come Halloween time, I should watch all the Saws.
Mm.
Next year. I didn't even say what The Searchers was. The Searchers is a 1956 film by John Ford. It's a Western. John Wayne is on a mission to save a woman who's been captured by Native Americans. It's a Western. Cowboys versus Indians.
And we watched a very dumb remake of it later.
What's the third film you watched, Andrew?
All right. So next up, I want to get the year. Because I was very curious about this episode. Because this is a movie that later you had said, oh, I kind of forgot about that movie and it keeps like slipping from my mind. So I wanted to listen again to your initial take on it. And that was Veronica Voss.
Oh, yeah.
From 1982, directed by Rainer Werner Fassbinder. Also, I wanted to listen to the two episodes where I defend the horrible actions of gay directors. I don't defend their actions. Yeah. I don't do that. But I do describe how they are problematic icons for me. And I just thought it was funny that I said that phrase twice. about two gay film directors. Why can't there just be a nice gay film director? Why can't there just be a nice director?
That's the real question.
Right.
That's a deep, dark question.
Yeah, I really enjoyed listening to this episode, and I was very nicely surprised to hear just how positive you were towards the film while we were recording it. I mean, it seemed to have had some sort of impact on you when you watched it, because you were talking about the connections to Sunset Boulevard and its connections to history at the time, and mm-hmm. the way it's discussing post-war Germany in such a direct and unobscured manner.
Now it's all coming back to me. Do you want to remind the listeners what the general plot is, though?
Right. Veronica Voss was a film from 1982 about this woman who was an actress in propaganda films for Germany during World War II. She worked with Nazis, and this is the story of her sort of descent into madness, which is not helped by these people who are taking advantage of her and want to kill her for her money, and how she feels like she has no place in this world anymore because no one will hire her as an actress again because she was such an icon of the Nazi movement. And it was based around the real life of an actress. Oh, man, I say her name four times in that episode and I've already forgotten. Sibyl Schmitz. And originally, Fassbender, the director of the film, had always wanted to work with Sibyl Schmitz. And when he found out that she had committed suicide because she felt she had no place in the world anymore, he suddenly felt inspired to write a film about her and her life in the sort of context of Sunset Boulevard, which is one of his favorite movies. And the really tragic part of it is that Fassbender himself died right after the film came out from overdosing. So it was sort of this reflection on a reflection on a reflection. And yeah, I just think it's a really great movie. It's in black and white. The whole film is meant to emulate films from the 50s, and it really looks like it. That's our number one talking point that we come back to multiple times, is how the film genuinely looks like a film that we watched in the 50s and feels like it almost belongs in that time period, and how impressive it is to pull off an aesthetic that well. So, yeah, I really enjoyed listening to this episode. Do you have any memories of this movie when you were watching it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I do want to say that you make a point throughout this project. I remember you saying this many times, that you think that the greatest insult to a film is it, like, if you just don't remember it. And I don't think I agree, just because my memory's bad. I think I just like forget films.
Is that
even
true?
If I really like them? Yeah. Even if I really like a film, I'll forget about it. And
no, I meant like, okay, because really, truly, my catchphrase, like literally my Superman slogan, is the worst thing you can say about a movie is that it's boring.
That is something you've said, for sure.
I just be saying shit, though.
I know you've said that, like, if you don't remember a film, or when I say, like, I've forgotten a film, I don't remember seeing something, you, like, have taken that as a great insult to the movie.
Well, I don't know what I'm
and
talking
about. And I don't
always
mean it as a great
ass. Yeah,
insult.
I'd be forgetting movies I like all the time.
Yeah, so Veronica Voss is definitely one of those films where, I mean, it's not my cup of tea. It's not a film that I would usually gravitate towards. I say that even though I really like movies about Hollywood and Sunset Boulevard. And I mean, this is basically Sunset Boulevard, like, in Nazi Germany or post-war Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. No, I really liked it. I really liked it, but it slipped from my memory. It did.
Well, I would like to go on the record now and say there's nothing wrong with forgetting a movie. It happens to the best of us. And I'm sure I have made those comments to Arthur before, because I really do just be saying shit sometimes. But I disagree with myself there, because I have, yeah, forgotten many movies. And then sometimes I'll rewatch them and think, how could I have forgotten about this? It's just because that's how memory works. You can't hold on to every single movie you see.
But I don't feel bad about forgetting The Thief of Baghdad. In that case, that is a boring film. I don't need that taking up space in my memory banks.
Everything you need to remember about it is luckily recorded on a podcast episode. If you ever need your memory jolted on it, you can listen to it and be like, oh, yeah. We talked about how the effect of the horse galloping through the clouds and it has wings. And we were like, can it not fly? Why is it galloping? And then the image of it just went immediately into my mind. And I thought, oh, yeah, that was a really dumb looking effect. I remember that now. So, but yeah.
I'm trying to think if I have any questions for you about Veronica Voss.
Well, the interesting thing about the Veronica Voss episode is that it was also a replacement, but it was just a replacement before we recorded the episode. Originally, we were supposed to do Fitzcarraldo.
Oh, yeah.
And I did not want to do an episode on Fitzcarraldo, and I still stand by that decision. And we mentioned that in the episode, how that was decided kind of last minute and how we threw that together in a couple days because the only way we were going to be able to watch Fitzcarraldo, this is not in the episode, this is a little backstage scoop. The only way Arthur was going to be able to watch Fitzcarraldo was through my DVD of it. And because of timing, there was just absolutely no way to get anything to him. And so it was like, well, we got to find something that's streaming. So I looked up movies from that year and saw it was on Criterion Channel and said Veronica Voss. And that's how that happened. Oh, and I was also, that was my first official COVID scare. And so I was locked away in my room. So, yeah.
What episode did you finally get COVID for?
Oh, I don't remember. There were like three in a row, yeah, in a row. Like we recorded one right at the top of me quarantining and one right at the end of me quarantining.
Sounds right.
But I can't remember when that actually happened. I remember it was relatively late. I think it was in the early 2000s.
Diligent listeners will know.
Yes. And they're like, how can you not remember? Because I don't remember anything. We just talked about that.
Anything else on Veronica Voss, though?
No, I was just really happy to listen to that episode again, sort of hear my opinion about the about the film itself and also about Fassbender and also how we kicked it off with being like, this is sort of an Andrew's obscure recommendation, making it into the official cut of the show, which was funny to me.
It is. Should we jump ahead literally just 1 year?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
1983 Scarface from director Brian De Palma. I re-listened to this episode because this is like the exact opposite of our Searchers episode. The one where you are like not okay with it and I'm over there being like it's Defender and saying it's fun and whatnot. Scarface, for those of you who don't know, is about Al Pacino. He's a Cuban immigrant coming to the United States, and he's no good. He climbs up the chain of command in the drug trade and becomes Tony Montana, the great, with the machine gun, just yelling one-liners and then being killed at the end. I mean, Scarface, it's Scarface.
I do think it's funny that we've so far picked a movie from the same decade every single time.
That is interesting, yeah.
I wonder what that means, or if it means anything. Yeah, I remember being not a fan, and I remember that sort of being a shock.
I'm still a little shocked. Has your opinion changed at all on Scarface? I mean, you didn't hate it. You were just kind of okay with it, but you were definitely leaning towards, like, this isn't good.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't revisited it. My opinion has stayed the same so far. My memories of that watching that film are not very positive. And I remember just thinking, and I remember it being a complicated thing for me because I'm such a huge fan of De Palma. And one of the reasons I'd never watched that movie was because everyone says, oh, this is a masterpiece. Like everyone said, this is De Palma's big, great work. And that always scares me when I watch it with that sort of knowledge, because I try my best to go in and clear expectations. But regardless of any expectations you clear at the end of the movie, you still have to deal with the fact this is the way the public perceives this movie. And I remember that being a very frustrating point to me when the movie was over, was he's just made so many great movies. He's just had such an amazing career. Why is this the one that everyone loves so much? I feel like it's such a huge departure from his other films and from his normal style. So I mean, I haven't revisited it. I still own the Blu-ray. I mean, I bought it on Blu-ray for that episode, too.
It's weird listening to myself in that episode because I feel like I'm spouting things that I don't actually believe. I say it in that episode, like, I'm usually the one being like, man, this is really a not okay film, like, you know, racial politics or what it's actually saying, or just it's just an ugly film. Like, I'm usually the one pointing out that kind of stuff or being like, you know, this was made under circumstances where the crew was abused and stuff like that. And that kind of stuff ruins a film for me. And you're usually the one who's like, well, if the art's good, it's fine. Like, you know, if it's aesthetically pleasing, then, you know, OK, there's still some merit to it. And I'm over there in Scarface in our episode being like, but isn't it just crazy? Like, isn't it just funny? Like, he's saying all sorts of funny things. Like, I was won over by Tony Montana. Like, Al Pacino plays this guy and just chews up the scenery to such a degree that, like, I just forget about my moral compass. And I'm saying things that I'm like, I don't think I actually believe that. The fact that the public totally, I think totally misinterpreted the meaning of the film, and, you know, that Tony Montana is, like, revered. Like, I think he's an interesting character, mm-hmm. but he's a tragic, like, dumb idiot. And the fact that, like, there are so many people out there who look up to him as some sort of idol. I'm like, he's miserable in that film. He gets everything he wants and he's miserable. Like, to me, that film is clearly a attack on the American dream, and it's like this great Gatsby story about how you can never have it all, right? Yet everyone takes it as this, I don't know. The fact that everyone misinterprets that film should mean that the film failed in some way. And usually that's my takeaway. Like, if your audience totally misinterpreted what you were going for, then the film failed. But in Scarface, I'm like, no, I'm still over there defending it. So I don't know. I feel like a little bit of a fool in that episode.
No. I mean, I feel like
that being you said, I still really like it.
Yeah, I think you just enjoyed the film and felt the need to defend it. If I had enjoyed the film on a base entertainment level, then I would have been fine with it. It was that I didn't enjoy the movie that made the whole thing complicated.
It's entertaining.
Yeah, I should watch again. I mean, I do have a really fond memory of the bathroom scene. Do I talk about that in the
chainsaw
episode?
Yeah, you love the violence.
I did love the violence.
You say that you're trying to find reviews and people who agree with your feelings about Scarface, but all you can find is these reviews where people are just deplored by the violence, right? Because it's so shocking.
Everyone
is just like, oh, this is so violent.
Even the only negative reviews I could find were all talking about how horrible the violence was. And I was like, no, that's the best part of the movie.
Right.
Yes, I do remember that. Yeah. That's so funny. Yeah.
So that's Scarface.
Nice.
I didn't listen to a fourth episode of our podcast for this wrap up. But Andrew, you went above and beyond. And
well, we're going to say that you did because you listened to the intermission. And that was how we kicked off this episode, was you sort of leaping off of that. So then we'll finish the recap here with the fourth one I listened to. And I want you to guess. Just give it one guess. I'll give you a hint. It's a really predictable one.
It's Three Colors Red.
No.
Oh, okay. I don't know.
It was The Handmaiden.
Can we talk about Three Colors Red real quick?
Okay. Yeah.
The Three Colors trilogy from this director, Krzysztof
Kieslowski.
Kieslowski. Thank you. The Three Colors trilogy, his magnum opus, coming out in 1994 with Red. And These are like huge films in the independent cinema scene. Like, everyone I know loves these. And the fact that I'm just like okay with them, just it just bothers so many people. So I've just entrenched, even though
you
I think
were
they're
pointedly
good.
Pointedly negative. It wasn't that you were just okay. In the episode, I remember you being pointedly negative. Saying that you wish that it had less connections than it did, and that you felt like none of it really amounted to much.
That does sound like me.
And that was a frustrating thing for me, because for me, it's like one of my philosophies of life is contained in that trilogy.
Yes,
I was like, well, that's kind of, that amounts to something, Arthur. Like, it amounts to who I am. But I mean, you know, I was respectful at the time, but then it just became this running gag ever since then, because I had been hyping up that episode for so long. And I ended up being disappointed in it, not because it was too much to cover in one episode in retrospect, the entire trilogy. And it was a big ask to watch an entire trilogy of films, even though you did do it sort of casually over the course of a month. But then to get there, I was not emotionally prepared for that reaction. In a way that I normally was very prepared for other episodes, that they could go either way. I sort of always had a plan of action for which way your opinion would sway on the film. And in that one, I sort of just took it for granted and thought, he's going to love these. So when I ended up having to defend them and answer these questions about them, it was something I hadn't really prepared myself for in any way. And I was like, I didn't get around to points I wanted to make, but also I don't think I would have gotten around to those points anyways. It was just sort of a mess. And then because of that, because there was like this weird emotion around that episode, I was like, you know what? How do I diffuse everything in life? Always through humor. So then I just sort of turned it into this running gag of like, whenever I could bring up that Arthur hates the Three Colors trilogy, I would do it in the episode.
And I, you know, I liked Blue. That's the first one. And then White was pretty funny. I liked it. And then we get to Red. And Red is supposed to be the best one. That's what everyone had been hyping it up to be. And Red by far was my least favorite of the three. And that was the one, you know, where we were actually focused on for our episode. So that was a little hard for me to navigate. But yeah, mainly just asking you in that episode, like, why do you actually like these? I don't get it. I don't get what the hype is. And you like explain it, and I'm like, no, I still don't get it. And it's just going around in circles.
And I do want to say that Three Colors Red being the favorite, I think, is an opinion I share with I would say the vast majority of people do think Blue is the best one.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I guess you hear from different people, they have different favorite ones. Yeah. I think I see on Letterboxd quite a few of the top reviews just saying that this is the best or something like that. I don't know. But yeah, it's become like a favorite, a pastime of mine now to subtly jab at the Three Colors trilogy, and it just drives cinephiles just nuts. They just hate it. So I'm entrenching even further. I don't get it. I tried too. I watched it twice. I watched it twice for you, man.
I know.
Yeah.
It was a very frustrating situation there. I had no idea what to do or how to navigate, and then was also kicking myself. I was like, Andrew, why didn't you prepare for this? It was just like a mixture of everything. But yeah, and I didn't have the courage to listen to that or the Persona episode. Not gonna lie, and you know, there's no disappointment. I was low key hoping you would listen to the Persona episode because I didn't have the courage to. But I will listen to it again, and the Three Colors like episode, because I'm gonna listen to the whole thing again.
I like that episode, the Persona episode, and I like Persona a lot.
Yeah.
I think that your philosophy, like why you love the Three Colors trilogy, correct me if I'm wrong, is it the same sort of like connectivity that you like in Cloud Atlas?
Yes, absolutely.
And I liked Cloud Atlas. That one worked for me.
Yeah, I almost listened to that one too. There was a lot that I was debating on in the later episodes.
I apologize, though. I derailed you. You want to talk about 2016's The Handmaiden.
I do. Yeah, I will say it again for like the 18th time on this project total, that this was one of the reasons I joined this project in the first place. And through many trials and tribulations with this project and great successes and, you know, sort of low moments, I really felt like hyping up towards The Handmaiden ended up being completely worth it. It was wonderful hosting that movie night with everyone and getting to see so many wonderful reactions to the film, including Arthur's reactions. And the episode itself went really, really well. And I was really happy with all the information I brought to the table and with the way we dissected that film and the way we contextualized it within the history of Japan and South Korea. And how we talked about the book and everything. I just really feel like that's a very educational and informative episode about a really great movie that I have a lot of passion for. And yeah, it also has a really sweet moment of me saying that, you know, if I could bring one person to watch this movie because of this, then that was enough. And I already did that because I got you to watch it, which I still think is a very tender thing to say in an episode. So yeah, I really enjoy listening to that episode, and I'm very proud of the work there.
Sell our new listeners on The Handmaiden. What is it about?
The Handmaiden is a twisty, turny thriller from Park Chan-wook. It is a historical drama about a young woman who goes to serve as a Korean woman who is dressed up and acting as a Japanese noblewoman's handmaiden. And it starts off as a con job where this handmaiden is attempting to get this other Korean woman to give up her clothing and her wealth. But the con goes multiple directions, and the film paces back on itself and folds in and out of itself and is sort of a labyrinth to get lost in. But then it solves it for you and gives you a really wonderful ending. And it's one of the best films in the LGBTQ cinema canon to date, and everyone should watch it. And it's also really sexy.
It's very sexy. Don't watch it with your parents.
Or do. I don't know. Your parents. I don't know how they are.
Oh, I guess. I don't know. I don't know. But good choice. Good choice. It's funny. All the films that I kind of gravitated towards that I wanted to revisit were the ones where we kind of had disagreements. The ones where kind of there's like hot takes. And I wanted to revisit those hot takes and see how they stood the test of time. And the films that you revisited, like LGBTQ canon films, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
I mean, even nice. Thief of Baghdad, I'd start off with being like, Douglas Fairbanks is just so hot. So that's what canonizes that.
Yeah, that's in the LGBTQ canon as well.
Yeah, I definitely found that I was gravitating towards the films where I had to defend a certain aspect, or where I got to educate in a certain way, which is something that I have a passion for doing. And nice. That was definitely a huge reasoning for the episodes I chose.
Yeah, solid episodes. Yeah, you revisited some good ones.
There aren't a lot of bad episodes.
I don't think so. Yeah, I'm proud of almost every single episode. I think there's merit to every single one. I do want to ask you, do you still think that Is Things to Come the worst film we watched on our entire list? Because in our intermission episode, that's where we are. We think that Is Things to Come is the worst film on our list.
No. No. I'm sorry. It was Bone Tomahawk.
It became Bone Tomahawk.
It was Bone Tomahawk. I detested that movie. Because, and I think if I remember correctly, I say this in the Bone Tomahawk episode, that Things to Come had that really dumb center chapter that where it went all Mad Max world and like the goofy cheesy villain and his goofy cheesy female henchwoman, and like even though it was really stupid and ridiculous, I was at least entertained and like what are we even doing here, and that was entertaining. Whereas with Bone Tomahawk, I was like, I want to turn this off. And even when we got to the violence and gore at the end, I was like, it was not worth the wait.
And I at least thought it was kind of fun. I don't know. It was all right.
Yeah.
But yeah, for the same reasons I don't like The Searchers, I'm like, this is pretty bad.
Yeah.
I don't know.
How about you?
I would never. I can't imagine recommending some of the early films to people. You know, The Thief of Baghdad.
Mm.
Even like The Phantom Carriage, I would have a lot of trouble like legitimately recommending to people. So are those like the worst films on our list, or are those just the ones that are like most inaccessible to a general audience?
I mean, I remember you loving Phantom Carriage when we were discussing.
Oh, I like it. Yeah. But like of the films on our list, that maybe like a Page of Madness. Page of Madness is a better example. Like that would be a hard recommendation for me to make.
Good Lord. You're going all the way back to the beginning. You're like retroactively saying that you liked something worse than Things to Come. This is a retcon. We did the intermission episode after we'd recorded all that.
My opinions can change.
That's true.
My opinions can change. I think A Page of Madness would be the hardest film for me to recommend. I don't know who I would recommend that film to, like, aside from you. aside from you and Graham, maybe.
I think logistically, one of the hardest films to recommend on our list is Twilight. That's not a joke. It has such a huge cultural resonance, and so many people already think they know what it is. If somebody already had made up their mind about Twilight, I think it'd be impossible to get them to watch it.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, that's not the question. The question is, what's the worst film? I'm kind of rethinking.
Yeah, I'm just going off of the standards you're putting out there.
Yeah. I think that I'm just going through the list real quick to see if anything else in the second half of the century, like, was worse. But I think I'm with you, man. I think Bone Tomahawk is, like, such an ugly film. And at least Things to Come has this genuine, like, hope for the future and this...
A fascist future, but still the future.
This perspective that's like, man, things are going to get really dark and bad, but it'll get better. You know, I don't hate Things to Come. It's a really fascinating film. And like I say in our intermission episode, like, I think about it a lot. I think about, you know, what were the people of the Great Depression thinking the future was going to be like? And Things to Come is a really, really fascinating film for that reason alone.
Yeah.
So Bone Tomahawk.
Do you have a movie that you feel like you're the most grateful for it being introduced to you? I mean, I know that's a huge ask with 100 movies in front of you.
I know. There's so many great ones. Like, I would just run down the list and, like, say, I would just recommend so many of these films.
Mm-hmm.
I love so many of them. Love, love, loved a lot of them. And for all sorts of different reasons, you know. I can't say one is the best. In our intermission episode, I do talk a lot about The Cranes Are Flying, and I still genuinely just love that.
That's one. That's so funny, because I was just about to say I have really fond memories of recording The Cranes Are Flying and, like, how much you loved
so
that. That's so funny.
It's so good.
Yeah. We're definitely on the wavelength. That was the first one that came to my mind.
It's just such a heartfelt, like, genuine anti-war film, like, coming from someone who lived, like, through the war and was on in the Soviet Union while it was being attacked by the Nazis. Like, it's so genuine. I love The Cranes Are Flying. You know, Phantom of the Paradise was fantastic. That soundtrack's a banger. I listen to that soundtrack, like, all the time.
Yeah. I love that movie, and that was a fun episode to record.
And I got to watch that in Austin. When I went to the Austin Film Festival, instead of going to see films at the Austin Film Festival, I saw that Phantom of the Paradise was playing at, like, one of the independent theaters, and I went and saw it with a crowd, and everyone was cheering, and it was so fun.
I was so jealous, yeah. Yeah, I remember that. I remember that the Pink Flamingos was, like, an all-time low. And then suddenly the Holy Mountain, Phantom Paradise, and Nashville, I remember all three of those. You were like, okay, okay, okay. Like, all three of those I remember you really, really loved.
I'm like, we're back in it. Yeah. Give me the 1970s. I'm here.
Do you feel like we have a strongest decade in any way?
There's good and bad in both. I do think we ended... No, I don't want to say that.
The decade that contained both of our least favorite movies.
But it had Handmaiden and Ghost Story and Hidden Life. It had so many good films.
Yeah.
You know.
For me, I thought the 90s were a really iconic decade. I know that The Three Colors Red didn't go the way it did you wanted it to. But for me, with that being one of my all-time favorite films, that decade lineup was just incredible. And I remember Showgirls being another big, like, high after the low, like, you being like, this is amazing. Yeah. So I thought the 90s were great. The 70s, yeah, were unbelievable too. But there is good and bad in both. It's true.
There's good and bad in every decade. But I do love the 1940s. Like, it just feels like classic Hollywood with, you know, Double Indemnity and The Third Man. But I love how a lot of these films tie to the war as well. World War II is, like, such a huge presence in the century. And all of our films are kind of tied to it in a way. You know, we have Rome, Open City, being shot and filmed in Rome, like right after the Nazis were kicked out. And you have The Best Years of Our Lives, like this really sentimental look at the American soldiers coming back from the war. And then you have Black Narcissus. And even though I didn't love The Red Shoes, like those two films are so they're so good.
Yeah.
Like back to back.
Oh, yeah. Has your opinion softened on The Red Shoes? I felt it softening even while we were recording. I just remember you were like, it's impossible not to compare them. And Black Narcissus was better. And I was like, it's hard to disagree, but Red Shoes I saw first. So that's kind of where I'm coming from with it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you just said that you thought they were both so good. So,
yeah. Yeah. Black Narcissus is my preferred film. I would still definitely recommend The Red Shoes to someone who, you know, likes that kind of that kind of genre.
Yeah. I'm looking at the 40s, too. I mean, Dance Girl Dance was such a fun movie to watch. I had such a great time. And yeah, of course, the third. Oh, I should have re-listened to The Third Man. I remember I had you cackling during that episode when I was telling you about all of the Orson Welles drama. That you were just dying while we were recording that episode. And I was having so much fun getting to tell you all of that stuff.
They tricked him onto the set with the
with
magician.
The magic trick.
So good. It's so good.
Yeah, I definitely feel like the entire 40s lineup are all films that I would recommend in good... What am I trying to say?
In good faith?
In good faith, maybe? I don't know where my brain was trying to go there. The words came out and then suddenly the thought wasn't there anymore. Anyways, all 10 of those films would be great recommendations and I think would be a great way to get people into older films.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, I remember Best Years of Our Lives. That was one off of the list of shame and I was very grateful. And Dan was a great guest on that.
Dan was a great guest.
Actually, this is probably a good time to go through and like thank our guests.
We can do that.
Yeah. I mean, it kicked off surprisingly early with Brian Higgins on Vampyr in 1932.
Brian Higgins coming in for Vampyr, right?
And that was wonderful. And I still hang on to his words when he said every story is someone going on an adventure or a stranger comes to town.
Oh, yeah.
I remember him saying that and I was like, huh, I don't know if that's an original or if he heard that somewhere, but I'd never heard that before and suddenly started cycling through every single narrative I was aware of and was like, oh, yeah, that's a really interesting way to put that.
He has such a calming presence. I really like Brian.
Yeah.
We should.
That episode was funny because it took us like 4 hours to start because my computer was updating.
Yeah, we need to like put it on air. We need to thank Brian Higgins for his patience because, yeah, he joined us to be a guest and we basically kept him in the lobby as we were trying to figure out technical difficulties on our end for a long, long time. So thank you, Brian.
Yes. So then our next guest was Dan Patterson on The Best Years of Our Lives, which was really great. And he brought a lot of perspective about the criticisms at the time, about the director and just about the film. And he had a lot of passion for that movie. And I thought that his perspective was really great there.
He has a great perspective on that like era of Hollywood cinema. Like,
yes,
I know we tried to get as diverse and like just as many films as possible. And I'm like loading it all into my brain and like trying to download so much. But there's something to be said about just like focusing on one era or one part of filmmaking that you really love and just becoming an expert in it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you can tell that he really has a passion for this time period in Hollywood.
And then our next guest was Tara LeBlanc for Invention for Destruction because...
And thank God.
Yes, because she is surprisingly well-versed in Czech animation of that time period. And she is a friend of mine and she... God, was she living with me yet? I can't even remember.
No, she wasn't living with you yet because we make a joke that that episode was so good that you invited her to be a roommate.
Yeah, and that was really great. She was so awesome on that episode and brought so much education to it. And yeah,
she's an artist. Like she's a graphic artist.
Right? Yes, she's a beautiful artist. She makes so much graphic art. She also makes 3D printed art. I mean, she helped me make a Halloween costume that I've worn 4 different times. Like she's amazing.
So she knows how to talk about the crazy animation going on in Invention for Destruction.
But yeah, I have no idea how we would have navigated that episode without her. But it was because I'd watched. She was the reason I was so interested in that box set, because she was the one who recommended Baron Munchausen off of that same box set, also from Carol Zeman, which, to my memory, you watched that one too, right?
I watched that one and I watched the dinosaur one.
Oh, I remember Tara and I, neither of us had seen that or Invention for Destruction. So we watched them all together. And I remember both of us wanting to fall asleep during the dinosaur one.
I know. I fell asleep to it, too. I thought it was wonderful.
You liked it?
Oh, yeah. The kids in the rowboat just watching dinosaurs on the shore. I mean, yeah, I loved it.
Gee, Willies, something like that.
Yeah, it's not an objectively good film, but there's something about it that's so childish and sweet that I appreciated it.
Yeah.
We brought Kagan Brighton back on for West Side Story.
And Phantom Paradise.
Because we love musicals.
Yes.
This project ended up just becoming Andrew tricking me into watching musicals.
I failed at the end. We did watch Bone Tomahawk and not The Lure. That punchline I didn't realize there was going to be a punchline to that joke. It's a very subtle one, but yes, throughout this whole project, I had done movie replacements and tricked him into watching musicals multiple times. And then one movie that I wasn't very interested in the first place, we both didn't like. And one of my favorite musicals came out that year, and we could have watched it. Yeah.
Well, goddamn it.
No, it's just funny in retrospect. Again, a subtle punchline to a joke that's set up throughout the whole show.
Well, Kagan's like one of my closest friends, and I work with him at the University of Utah.
He's great.
And yeah, he is great. And he just had his own show come out, Bloody Cabaret Live. And my God, it was spectacular.
I wish I could have seen that. I was in Alabama. Yeah.
Dude is super talented, just an incredible musician and composer. And yeah, he brings, just like Tara, you know, he brings the artistic touch of his own medium, his intelligence to these two musicals. And he talks all about the music in a way that I never could. I mean,
yeah, he and I still have not done our collab for Phantom Paradise. He said that he wanted me to sing Jessica Harper's big solo, Old Souls, with him playing the piano, and we still haven't done that. I want to do that. I love that song. Come on, Kagan. Let's do it. Let's collab. Let's collab, baby. I'm free now. I'm a free man.
At least until something else comes up. So.
And then our next guest was one of my closest friends, Noah Cannon. On the Manhattan episode, he was also with us for the Cloud Atlas episode.
Now, why did we bring Noah on?
Because he loves Woody Allen.
Oh, to defend Woody Allen. That's right. We had to get, as you know, Tara brings her knowledge of art. Kagan brings his knowledge of music, and Noah brings his knowledge of pedophilia.
God. Noah has been a longtime supporter of this podcast and a longtime member of our Patreon. And he defends Woody Allen on air.
It's like the funniest guy. Noah's like significantly funnier than me. So I am jealous of him in those two episodes, but that's okay.
Don't be jealous. I mean, he's funnier than me too.
You two play off each other really well.
That's true. We have decades of building up a rapport.
Yeah, this two-man act that's been crafted into a beautiful show.
And we see each other all the time. He was just here this past weekend.
Oh, did he watch Avatar with you?
He did. He came and saw The Way of Water with me.
Yeah, nice, nice, nice.
With him on Manhattan and Cloud Atlas, those really are two of my favorite episodes to listen to. They both make me laugh so hard. And I agree with you. I listen to them and I think, Noah and I really are like this two-man show. We should be like on the road or on stage or something. This is so funny to listen to. And he brought a lot of information, and it was very good to have his knowledge for both Manhattan and Cloud Atlas. And it was really nice to have him there for Cloud Atlas specifically, because he and I both had such similar journeys and trajectories with that movie. And I knew that was going to be a complicated episode to record because of how much information is in that film and how many times I'd seen it versus you watching it for the very first time. So it was good to have someone else there to sort of bounce off of and be like, this is why this movie is so important to not just me, but this other person as well.
So. Yeah, and that movie has haters out in the world.
Major
people
haters.
Who are attacking it all the time. I have only heard bad things about that film. So it was great to hear, you know, from two people who really loved it. And I think there's absolutely merit in Cloud Atlas. I really liked watching it with you. And I can't wait to watch it again. Yeah. Cloud Atlas was good, guys.
Yeah.
I think Cloud Atlas is our longest episode. So kudos to you and Noah.
He wanted it to be. He said that during the recording.
Yeah, and I mean, it
we made it happen. The next guest after Manhattan was Chandler Burns for Amadeus, one of my very good film friends. But yes, Chandler was wonderful to have on that episode. He was hilarious and he was very passionate about the movie. And I was grateful to get to involve him because he'd been a friend of mine for a long time in film. And yeah, that was fun.
I just will never forget our Patreon episode with him afterwards where he attacks James Cameron's aliens. I don't even remember what we were trying to make the Patreon episode about, but it ended up becoming you defending aliens.
One of the greatest action movies of all so time.
I was like, coming out of nowhere.
I was like, just we can't do this. I love this movie. Yeah, I remember that too.
But he works for the Sundance Film Festival.
Yes, and he just recently worked for Tribeca Film Festival out in New York. And now he's still living out in New York City and is making things work out there. So I'm going to visit him soon.
Hell yeah. Yeah, so he had some good perspective on what was going on in Sundance at the time.
Mm-hmm. And I also remember watching that with him. And it was really nice because we'd both seen it so many times. It was nice to sort of have a running commentary with him of us talking about that movie. And it always means a lot to me when things I say seem to have an impact on people. Like, it's a very small thing, but it really does mean the world to me. And I always try and tell people when things they've said has made an impact on me. And I remember that during the recording of the episode, he was like, I'd never really considered it before, but Andrew brought it up. And now I can't stop thinking about how good the editing is in this movie. And that meant a lot because I remember telling him at the beginning when we were watching it, like, I was like, this is one of the greatest edited films I've ever seen. It blows my mind the way it's all connected. And that was nice. It was a nice thing.
He had so much to say about Amadeus. I mean, you could tell he's been studying it like his entire life. Mm-hmm. Like he absolutely loves it. He could probably record a 5-hour episode of just Amadeus and it would be successful and it would be really insightful. So thank you for lending that to our show. Yes. And then in 1987, we got my friend Stefan Glynn coming in hot for Predator.
This was a really fun recording session.
And I mean, Stefan is another one of my very good friends. Love this guy.
Yeah.
And he got me into Jean-Claude Van Damme back in college because he wrote his college thesis on Jean-Claude Van Damme's body being like usurped by the imperialist pigs in America. Like, it's so good. It's so good.
And I remember that for the Patreon, he made me watch that montage of the Jean-Claude Van Damme split, which brought a lot of joy into my life. I thought that was
it's so good.
Hysterical. I loved that.
Stefan also has a really calming presence. So thank you for bringing that as well.
Yeah. And I remember when we started recording that he was like talking about how nervous he was. And I was like, really, like, we're just having a conversation. So I remember sort of getting to use my extroverted instincts and being like, so what are you up to these days? And like just sort of talking with them and then casually leading the conversation into the podcast recording, which is a skill of mine that I'm very proud of. And I was really happy to be able to do it there. I'm good at like diffusing nerves.
Stefan was most nervous about his audio recording quality.
Right.
The man is extremely talented when it comes to post-production. And I mean, he just knew that he wasn't bringing his A game for the audio recording. And I think that was just making him nervous.
Yeah.
But you know, he's a guest. He's allowed to have bad audio.
Oh yeah.
People phone in all the time. I've listened to a podcast where the guest is just on their cell phone, right? Just recording it off their cell phone. They sound like garbage.
Well, didn't we have multiple guests do that?
On our very podcast.
I don't think they sounded like garbage.
No, I've definitely listened to podcasts outside of ours where the guest sounds like garbage.
Yeah.
And it's okay. And it's okay.
But Stefan brought a lot of knowledge about the action genre, and it was really fun to hear his passion for the genre as well as for that film specifically. And I feel like it brought a lot to that episode, and I'm very grateful for him.
Yeah, because Predator is often seen as just like a silly B movie or, you know, just a monster movie. But the perspective of how it fits into Reagan's America and the trajectory of Arnold Schwarzenegger's career, why the public loves this kind of person, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and these foreign action stars. Yeah, Stefan's all about that.
Mm-hmm.
Who's our next guest?
Our next guest was 1999, The Virgin Suicides. It was one of my closest friends of all time, been with me for a long time in my life, and that's James Westervelt. And we also lived together for 10 years.
We love James.
Mm-hmm. James is a wonderful, wonderful human. Spending my Christmas with him this year, we both don't have anything to do for Christmas, so we're cooking a nice meal. Do you have anything to do for Christmas?
I got my parents here, yeah.
Okay, okay.
I remember I didn't invite James to my birthday party this year, but he showed up, and that just made my night. I was so wonderfully happy to see him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I dragged his ass there.
Yeah. And thank you for doing
that. He and I are polar opposites of the social thing. I always am trying to break social norms, and I'm like, oh, it doesn't matter if you get invited somewhere. If you go in and make the party better, then everything's fine. Where he's like, oh, I don't think I'm supposed to go to that, blah, blah, blah. And so that one especially was like, no, Arthur wants you to be there. Like, we all want you to be there. And he was like, okay, are you sure? And I was like, yes, I'm sure. And we showed up, and yeah, it was a great time. And he got along with everybody, and it was a wonderful party.
So, Virgin Suicides.
I thought he was great on this episode.
And he was, yes.
I mean, yeah, this is one of his favorite movies. And I liked the perspective he brought from having read the book, where he thought the film was better, essentially. And that the context he was looking for from the book didn't come. And then he was like, well, the movie was more beautiful for me.
You never hear people say that.
Yeah.
Well, you do, but it's a very rare statement.
Yeah, you hear people say about Fight Club, but I disagree with that.
You think the book is better than the movie there?
I just think they're on very equal playing fields. I don't think it's as cut and dry as people want it to be.
Okay. But I love it when someone, you know, can see the merits of filmmaking as an art, and they can see, you know, why were things cut? Why did these changes need to be made? Whereas a lot of other people, you know, they'll read the book and they'll be like, well, the book had more stuff. It just had more stuff. Mm-hmm. So therefore it's better. The film had to cut things. So therefore it's worse. And I just totally disagree with that.
Right.
As I was saying earlier, just because something is longer doesn't mean it is better.
As far as like taking in information from something, I feel like I have watched The Shining so many times and have only read it once. The movie seems to have more of an impact on me than the book does.
There we go.
So I think that's one instance. But yes, I should revisit this episode, The Virgin Suicides. I don't think I've listened to it since it dropped. But I do remember the joke at the beginning with him talking about the double pack of American Beauty and the Virgin Suicides. And it was like how to get your depressed preteen to commit suicide or something was what I called it. And he said, how to get your beautiful depressed preteen to commit suicide. That really killed me. That was so funny to me. That's what both those movies are. This weird death fantasy.
Well, thank you, James, for joining us for The Virgin Suicides.
And for everything else.
Of course. And then another longtime listener and collaborator with you joined us in 2007.
And this was our last one, right? Well, besides Noah again.
Yeah.
But that was, yes, my very good friend and collaborator, Elise Hansen, on our Persepolis episode, which was so wonderful. And that was such a kismet moment. And it really was a confirming thing for me, because I really do hold it as a point of pride that I can find a good movie to recommend to somebody. And when she got on the episode and started talking about how she had a family member named Marjan and all of these connections that she was able to draw with the source material and the plot, I didn't know any of that before we recorded. And I was like, I don't know. I was a little proud of myself, because I was like, how did I know this was the right one to get Elise on? I don't know, but it definitely was. And she was great. She was such a wonderful podcasting partner on that and brought a lot of historical context. And I feel like she really enjoyed the film, which was a nice thing too. And that was just a great movie.
And Persepolis was just a great movie. I really liked Elise. And you know, she's a theater director, so it's not quite the same. But I feel a kinship with her as someone who makes things and tries to build something out of nothing and just drive these huge projects. And she gets it. So she brought a lot of, I don't know, relatable insights about the process of just making art. Mm-hmm. And I liked talking with her. I think that was the first time I had talked with her, was when we recorded that.
Oh, really?
I think I hadn't met her before that. I don't think we had been introduced before that. But we've talked since then. I've seen her quite a bit now, that I've come to some of her plays and seen you. I must have said hello to her.
Yeah, because you'd seen plays that we'd done together before that.
Yeah. So, anyways.
And she, yeah, no, I had, no, yeah, y'all had talked because I had introduced you two. Because she was excited when you were coming to the first place since the podcast had started. I was like, Arthur's going to be there tonight. She's like, oh my gosh. Because she'd been listening from the very beginning. She'd been a big fan from the very beginning.
Elise. Oh, thank you, Elise. I'm just getting my timeline mixed up then.
But yes, Elise is a wonderful human. And she and I had a roller coaster of a year together this year. But we really hung on and we really, I feel like, did some amazing work through it.
You guys did. Yeah. All these plays. So many plays.
So many plays. And she did more than I did.
So thank you so much to all of our guests for coming
on and joining us. It was such a pleasure to get to have people who were loving the show. I mean, every single person who we had as a guest was someone who had listened to it and had been a fan of it. And it was just really nice to be able to involve you all.
And bringing your own expertise and expanding on the films in ways that, you know, we could not have. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that just makes the show so much better. So, yeah, really, really appreciate it.
Yep. I would do, if we were to do this again, I would want more guests.
Yeah, I would dig that. It becomes a little harder to edit on my end and there's longer episodes, but mm-hmm. I think they're totally worth it. I wanted to ask you, do you have any big takeaways from this whole project?
Big takeaways from this whole project? I mean, the answer is yes. I'm just trying to put it into words. I mean, this was a very affirming and very wonderful project to be a part of. It was really, I don't know, it was just really cool to have something to look forward to every single week of, okay, like, this is a piece of art that I'm involved in, that I am a huge collaborator for and author of, that's coming out every week, you know? I think that probably my biggest takeaway was that, you know, art is not easy, which is something I learn with every single project in a different way. And I remember when I joined this early on in 2020, I don't think I could have ever predicted how much work and time and effort it would have taken. And I'm grateful for that, because I feel like if I had had that future sight, my inner voice would have been like, don't do it. That's so much work.
Oh, no.
But I'm really grateful that I did accept it and that I did do it, because I felt like it was very rewarding work and it was mm-hmm. a project that I'm extremely proud of. And yeah, it was just cool. And also I got all this recording equipment to record music, which is really, really hard. And I'm still trying to teach myself how to do that. But I can't guarantee that over the past 2 years, if I hadn't been podcasting, that I would have then been recording music. You know what I mean? Like, there's mm-hmm. no guarantee on that. So I'm really happy I was able to use all of this stuff that I got during the quarantine process and that I was able to make something with it, because it's immediately like this became an investment that was worth it.
Right.
So,
well, nice. I would second everything you said. Yeah, it's a lot of hard work, but it's rewarding to finish any project and to see something to come together, and to have an audience of people who are getting something out of it is very, very rewarding. And we'll talk about that in a second, I guess. But especially in these last 50 weeks, these last 50 years, episodes, whatever, like my philosophy on watching films has shifted quite a bit, I think. And even just like listening to some of the earlier episodes, like the Nanook and Searchers, like just thinking back to how I used to watch movies back then, I think I've accepted that movies are way more communal than I ever like gave them credit for. Mm. And that's weird because you kind of sit in the dark and you watch them and you're silent. You're not talking to anyone. Usually, I mean, you can make comments or whatever while you're watching a movie, but it's not like you're having a conversation with something, but you're still sitting there with people in an audience and, you know, with your friends, and you're watching something together and you're experiencing something.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, I've always said that I'm okay watching movies by myself. That is true still. I will go to the theater by myself and watch a movie and still get something out of it. Mm-hmm. But this project, and especially the fact that I watched all these films technically with you, right? Like, maybe not all the time with you, but we watched these together.
Most of the time separately, yeah.
Most of the time separately, but then we talked about it for a long time after the fact. I don't know. It just affirmed that films are so integral to a community, to a communal human experience. And yeah, I think that becomes harder as you get older to really like pin that down and like make time for it. Like in college, I remember with my roommates and whatnot, you like when you have roommates, you can just sit down any night and watch movies together and you get something out of it. But now that I'm living alone, I don't have roommates. I broke up with my girlfriend, which is very sad, and I don't have someone to like call upon to watch movies, mm-hmm. I guess. Something about watching movies has changed since then. And I have struggled to find time or energy to watch movies if I don't have someone to watch them with. Mm. Even though I'm usually okay watching them by myself, it's very different. I can't do that for every movie now. I think I have to have people to watch them with. And it's also getting hard as we get older to get people together for anything.
Right.
And Kagan and I were just talking about this as well. Like, if I can finally get certain people, if I can pin them down and get time to spend with them, it becomes hard to convince them to go to a movie. It becomes harder to get them to go or come over and just sit down and like not talk to each other and watch something else. Like, we want to catch up, we want to like play a game, or we want to go out and drink and like talk to each other, mm-hmm. Because I haven't seen them in months or something like that. So I don't know, like I'm becoming really more selective with the films I watch. They have to speak to me, they have to be really good, they have to be something I'm really interested in order for me to really seek them out. So I think my philosophy towards filmmaking and watching movies is shifting. Because of stuff going on in life, but also this project has helped me realize like what the merits actually are. And that is like getting something out of it together with other people.
Right.
And finding kinship with people through your shared interests in cinema.
Yeah, I think it's really important to have a film community. I mean, I'm very fortunate to have the friends I have and Salt Lake Film Society people as well. And there's just no getting around the fact that every movie I see, to a certain extent, I'm trying to reach out to people and be like, hey, have you seen this? Do you have opinions on this? That sort of thing. And
want to talk about it with people. Yeah. Exactly. This project would have not been the same if I didn't have you, someone intelligent to talk to and like someone very knowledgeable to talk to afterwards and giving me a new perspective on all the films we watch. You know, like that's what the real... It's like, it's not even about watching the movies. It's about talking with someone about the movies. Mm. That's where the real joy is in watching movies. And that's kind of weird to, I don't know. Is that weird or is that obvious? Like, does everyone already know that?
I don't think that's weird. I think it's personal. And for me, there are plenty of films I've seen that I can't really find many other people who have seen. And I do have a conversation with the art piece itself. And I've come around to that on a personal level. I won't lie, it is more difficult for me to watch films by myself than it is when I have people who are all there to watch a movie. But it's a discipline that I'm happy to have honed up. I can admit that in the last month, and I mean, it's mainly been because of Angels in America, but I have not been watching too many films. But almost every film that I've watched over the past month has been by myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I went and saw Banshees of Inisherin. I saw the Del Toro Pinocchio. These were all movies that I just went to by myself in theaters.
And and it's good to have that conversation with the art piece by yourself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people can't do that at all.
Right. So
at least we can get something out of it.
It's like reading a book, you know, reading a book is a very personal journey that you take with you and the piece itself. And you don't go into a book expecting to have a discussion with somebody afterwards about it. It's nice if you can, mm-hmm. but it's not necessary to the art. But if you feel like film as an art form for you is something where the discussion and the social aspect of it are a necessary part, I have respect for that. Major respect for that.
Yeah, it's not 100% necessary, but I don't know. I've come around to seeing it as more of a communal thing. It's just been good talking to you. I don't know.
For me, it goes in waves. It definitely goes in waves. I have these waves of like, I don't want to watch anything right now. And I always just sort of let that wave happen. I go through different waves with different art forms. I go through video game phases. I go through book phases. I go through music phases and I go through film phases. And normally during all of the other phases, I'm still, you know, I'm still like listening to music casually. I'm still reading a book or something small, or at least articles every single day to keep myself well informed. But there's always one piece of art that sort of takes the front, and that's where I'm putting my energy into.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If those are big takeaways for us, I mean, I know people have said they really like listening to us. Is that kind of what the big takeaway is for our audience? Is that sort of like a communal feeling, like you can watch these older obscure films or just random films from throughout the century and then feel like you're having like a social bond with us? Is that like the big takeaway for an audience of people with a podcast like this?
I don't know. That's a tough thing for me to gauge. We never really did this for anybody but ourselves.
I definitely wanted the podcast to be like educational.
Yeah, I hope that's exactly what I was about to say, is that I hope people feel like they've been educated by the end of an episode and that they've learned something and had a perspective shared that they didn't consider before.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Overall, I'm just extremely proud of this project and yeah, very grateful to have been a part of it. And it really is crazy to me that it's over. But that's part of life and that's part of art too, is that eventually you do have to let it go.
And here we are letting it go.
Letting it go.
In the intermission episode, you had said that you were really looking forward to Elden Ring.
Oh, which I never beat.
And I am in the process of trying to beat right now. Yeah, talk about like an art form kind of like taking over your life. Yeah, for the past month, it's probably been me just slamming my head against a wall as I try to get through Elden Ring.
It's been video games for me, too, but I've been revisiting Persona 5. I'm playing the Royal Edition this time.
Very nice.
I think that's a natural fit. I mean, we just spent 2 years sort of forcing movies to be the forefront. And now we need something that requires like a little bit more hand-eye coordination and like physical interaction with the screen in our downtime. But I think it will even out.
It'll even out. Yeah, we'll find the balance once more. It's winter time. I always say that I really like playing video games in the winter time. You stay inside and cozy up and play your video game.
Because also every film I've seen in the past month, even the ones I've seen by myself, have all been in theaters. I haven't watched anything at home.
Yeah. Yeah, me neither.
So it's just a part of it. And I knew this was going to happen around when we started recording episodes in the 90s. I suddenly realized, geez, we're going to finish this project and I'm going to take a break like from movies, because it was just crazy to like sort of be forced to watch one every single week. And I did enjoy it, but there were some weeks where I was like, I don't want to watch a movie this week, but I have to because I've made this obligation. And
yeah,
you know, I didn't mind that at all. It was a good discipline to keep, But, you know, now we get like sort of a cheat day of like, okay, I don't have to watch a movie this week, so I'm not going to. But eventually I'll get right back into it. I mean, I still have so many films on my watch list, so many films on my shelf to knock off, so many ways to educate myself in the history of film and the culture of film. And it's a medium that continues to grow and astound me.
In our intermission episode, we had talked about like kind of some broader things we noticed about the first half of the century in cinema and, you know, how film was finding itself as an art form and how that's really exciting to see. And then getting to the studios collapse in the 50s and the 60s. And like there's kind of a story to tell there. Do you think there's another story that's going on in the second half of the century in cinema?
God, I think it's the same story. I think film is still finding itself. I think the medium is still growing. There's still like this crazy studio crash and boom thing happening right now of the different major studios all trying to beat out Disney now and the smaller independent studios sort of getting more of a leg up by finding adult audiences who want something different from movies. So yeah, it's still an interesting medium to keep up with. It's an amazing art form.
Oh, my favorite quote about history is that history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And yeah, you can feel it as we move really quickly through all these decades. You can feel film history repeating itself, but not really. It's fun to see.
I feel like that's what Cloud Atlas is about. History doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme.
Even more merit to the film. We love it.
Yeah.
I would say let's make predictions about the future of film, but
Avatar 3 will come out in 2024.
There we go. Let's make predictions about the future of film in our Patreon episode, our very last Patreon episode where we talk about Avatar and maybe what the future of film looks like.
Okay. Yes. To all of our Patreon listeners, we will be discussing Avatar: The Way of Water as our Patreon finale, because in the Patreon episodes, I've been hyping it up so much that it just feels right to discuss it since we both saw it this weekend.
Hell yeah. Just came out a couple days ago. Exciting times to be a moviegoer. I think that's it.
That's it.
But I think that's it.
That's it. Thank you all so much for listening. We really appreciate it. And this is your first episode. If you made it all the way to the end of this one, God, you should listen to one about a movie now. This is just us like talking.
Yeah, go listen to something else. Go listen to Three Colors Red.
Go listen to Three Colors Red.
Go listen to Cloud Atlas.
Go listen to Cloud Atlas. That's one of our best.
Go listen to anything you want.
Exactly. It's your playground now. We're leaving this to you now. We're done. We finished it. It's over.
As long as it's our podcast, you can listen to whatever you want.
Yes. In whatever order you want.
Yeah. Jump around. I'm ending it. Andrew, thank you so much. I love you, buddy.
Thank you, Arthur. I love you, too. And I'm very grateful for you.
Thank you for everything. To our lovely audience, thank you so much. To our Patreon subscribers, thank you so much for supporting the show. And of course, thank you to my good friend Nathan Royal for the show's music.
Thank you, Nathan Royal. I'll meet you one day.
I'm wondering if there's anything else to throw in at the end, but...
No, I think that's it.
But I think that's the end.